use it for anything, but it's especially designed for competition. You know, precision. It's got real nice symbols in it. And I really enjoyed it. But just not doing it anymore, so I'd be willing to. So you maybe just check on and see if you can find somebody that'll fix one of the stick pots, one of the potentiometers in the stick, I think is the problem. And see, and then I'll consider. You can find out roughly what it costs to fix it, and I'll give a fair price for it. Okay. Looking at the sons of Israel. Did the bell ring? Okay. Just want to make sure I don't start before. I don't trust the clocks around here. This one's pretty good in this room. But some of them are. Yeah, I'm really honest about that. I just sometimes I do, and sometimes I hear it, but I don't pay any attention to it. You know. Okay. So I need your help sometimes. Okay, Levi is the next one, verse 34. She conceived again and bare a son and said, "Now this time will my husband be joined unto me, because I have borne him three sons. Therefore was his name called Levi." Levi means joined, as we've said before. And the point here that she's making is, "Now will my husband be joined unto me." But this never really happened. Now, obviously, she doesn't mean physically, because that's already taken place. But she wants his love. And she knows that his love isn't the same as it is for Rachel. And as it turned out, there's no evidence that Jacob ever changed his mind about that. He always loved Rachel more. So it's a type of the fact that you cannot earn God's love with our works. So she's figuring now, well, now that I've got another son, he'll love me. But it just doesn't work that way. Love doesn't work that way. We're not going to earn God's love. Now, fortunately, God is not partial with his love and arbitrarily loves someone, doesn't love others. He loves us all. But you're not going to earn his love. You just need to receive it. Now, we can be joined also to our heavenly bridegroom. This word Levi meaning joined. There will be a joining that will take place, and that's by virtue, of course, of the gospel and the unity that comes as a result of that. John 17, verses 20 to 22 is a reference. John 17, verses 20 to 22, that we may be one. And Jesus' prayer is that we be one with him and with God. And of course, we will. That's the joining that we're talking about. That's the ultimate fulfillment of the meaning of this name. That's the fulfillment of what the priesthood was all about in the Old Covenant. Okay, verse 35. And she conceived again and bare a son. And he said, "Now will I praise Yahweh." Therefore, she called his name Judah and left bearing. So she praises Yahweh now with another son. And the Hebrew Judah means praise Yah, and literally the Hebrew word is Yehudah. Yehudah, and of course we pronounce it Judah in the transliteration or the way in the anglicized pronunciation. Y-E-H-U-D-A-H, Yehudah is the Hebrew form. And this is a type, again, of national Israel in respect, which bore Christ. National Israel brought forth Christ, brought forth the Messiah, just as Judah did. And the Messiah, of course, is not only just man, but also God, and he's to be praised. And it says she left off bearing after this. It's interesting in typology. After the Old Covenant produced Christ, they left off bearing. It was not in the Old Covenant anymore. Now it's in the New. And things now are going to shift to Rachel. But the word for Jew, interesting enough, comes from the word Judah. And the word Jew in Hebrew is Yehudi, which is just the way that they would... It in effect, is something like saying Judahite or something, Yehudi, as a Jew. And that term has been derived from Judah. Now, Judah, of course, became, later on when the tribes divided, three tribes to the south and the ten tribes that followed Jeroboam to the north, when the division came after after Solomon's reign, Judah became the predominant tribe in the south, and, of course, the whole nation became known as Judah, even though it was actually Judah and Benjamin, and also Levi, some of Levi was there, a good portion of Levi, because the northern kingdom wouldn't allow them to minister the way that God intended. Now, you might include as a parallel to this, Genesis 49:8 says, "Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise." So his name involved with praise, praise Yah, and it connects that the meaning of his name with something's going to happen in his case. Romans 2:29 also Romans 2:29, which is dealing with the spiritual end of this. He is not a Jew which is one inwardly, one outwardly, but he is a Jew which is one inwardly, whose praise is not of men but of God. And it says whose praise is not of men but of God, picking up on the meaning of the word, meaning of the name Judah, meaning praise again. So if we're going to receive praise and be a true Jew, the praise is going to come from God, not from men. Okay, then we go on, chapter 30 and verse 1. So Leah leaves off bearing at this point. We'll find she'll bear some other children later, but at this point that was it. Now verse 1 of chapter 30. And when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die, as if it was his fault. So she's envying her sister. She's showing, and again we're seeing a clear manifestation of the problems of polygamy and the weaknesses of flesh and so forth. And it shows the truthfulness of the scriptural account, the fact that God is telling you just like it is, and he's telling you the problems and struggles that go on with this polygamous relationship, which is another argument for inspiration, really. I mean, if you were thinking that this whole Bible was concocted by people who were just trying to offer some religion, they wouldn't recount things as they are like the Bible does. The Bible tells you all the bad things as well as the good things, tells you the problems as well as the glories and the victories. Men don't write books that way. And it's quite a testimony that this was not the product of men. It's certainly not the men at that time. Certainly Jacob wasn't writing about all the things, and Abraham wasn't writing about all his lying to Pharaoh and all of this. It's written by inspiration of God. Now, God can also, another interesting facet of this is God uses man's wrath to praise him. Psalm 76:10 says that God will use the wrath of man to praise him. How is that the case here? Well, the things that are going to happen here as far as the birth of these sons largely stem from conflict, struggles, and fleshly jealousies and so forth between these two wives. But out of that, God brings forth a nation of 12 tribes that he's going to use to glorify his name. And so it's quite an interesting twist, the way that God works through things. He works through situations, even situations that are not good situations. We see that Jacob himself, with the situations that he was involved in, was not on the in the right all the time that he conducted himself. Yet God is working through all of those circumstances. And so there's a type here, in a sense. There's a struggle also between the visible church representing Leah and the invisible church. That is Christ's true love, but she has no children as yet. And we're seeing that go on even now. There's a struggle between the outward church system, the visible church that claims that, you know, they're the ones that are earning the love of God because of their bearing children, and they've got all kinds of big outward show. But there's an inward church that hasn't born yet. And one of these days, that church is going to be bringing forth and manifesting itself to the earth as far as the man-child is concerned. Now, the Christians, there's another type here, too, and that is that Christians will often envy one another's ministries, even now. Even among the saints, there's unfortunately a lot of carnality and things that are going on. Competition. Some of the healing ministers used to have competitions, who could build the biggest tent and have the most people in their meetings and so forth. Pure carnality. And yet, God didn't cut them off just like that. And lots of souls were brought into the kingdom of God, some of it because of the competition these ministers were having. And they were holding meeting after meeting after meeting, and it wasn't all with the purest motives, and yet God worked through it. So it is with this situation with the sons of Israel. And Mark 9:39, there's just a few other scriptures on this. Mark 9:39, John was forbidding a man who cast out demons in Christ's name, and Jesus told him, you know, if he's not against us, he's for us. But there was this competition between the ministers. Numbers 11:29 also. Numbers 11:29, Moses is talking to Joshua, "Enviest thou for my sake?" And again, there was envies and there was strife in some instances, potential problems. And yet God will work through human vessels, even though they're not perfect. Not condoning it, but working in spite of it. Okay, so she's saying, give me children, else I die. This can also typify the invisible church calling upon Christ for fruit. That's in effect what we're saying, give me children, else I die. We need to bring forth fruit. And it was a very great reproach, as we've already discovered, for a Hebrew woman to be barren. There was one Hebrew proverb, not a scripture proverb, but a saying that said that a childless person is as good as dead. And, you know, that's kind of give you an idea of what the way they esteemed having children. But Rachel's pettiness can also be seen here in the fact that Jacob had served 7 years for her and gave her a certain amount of prestige over Leah and the other girls of Haran and so forth, that this man labored 7 years to get her. And then when he served another 7 years for her, that was even added more. And I'm sure it went to her head to a degree that, you know, this man would give that much for her. But God may be wanting to humble her too and keep her in the right position. And she's been barren. She hasn't been bringing forth. She's having an opportunity now to see what kind of a person she's really made of inside. And we're seeing some of the flesh be manifest. She's being put to the test. She's in the fire of affliction. So we need to interpret her remarks sometimes in the light of the pressure that's on her at the time. And it just lets us know again that there's real flesh involved. And God is seeming to put the light on the flesh of all of these Old Testament saints. And yet in the end of all of it, he calls them those that had faith and were not wavering and you know, gives them a real good report card at the end. So that's something to remember. Your report card at the end is going to be how you come through the trials, not the problems and struggles that you have in the process. Verse 2, and Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel. And he said, am I in God's stead? Who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? So he's getting a little peeved at the insinuation that, you know, give me children else I die, as if he could do something about it. He's, you know, he's been fully cooperative here. But he says, who hath withheld you from holding, who hath withheld from thee the fruit of thy womb? In other words, this is a thing that was in the hands of God. Jacob was not sterile, and he was undoubtedly having intercourse with Rachel as well as Leah. So he implies here that there must be something wrong in her life. In other words, it's on her side, not on his side. And of course, their concepts were that God, you know, was not blessing her with children, so there must be some problem. That's not always the case, and certainly it wasn't here in itself. It just said that Rachel was barren. God had not chosen to open her womb at this time and is allowing a test to come and so forth, but it wasn't necessarily because anything intrinsically bad that she'd done in her life that she needed to correct. But she needed to have patience and wait upon God and come to the Lord. If there's any failing, I suppose it's, the main thing is not putting the whole thing in God's hand. Remember that Rebecca, her mother-in-law, had, when this similar situation befell her, she went to the Lord and inquired of the Lord as to what was the problem here. She put it in the matter in God's hands. Rachel apparently has not done that here. So if there's any problem, that would be the main one. And little did she know that when she did finally have children, she would die as a result of it and giving birth to Benjamin. Okay, third verse. And she said, behold, my maid Bilhah, go in unto her, and she shall bear upon my knees, that I may also have children by her. And so this is again the custom. Bilhah, in the Hebrew, means tender. And the same mistake that Sarah had made in giving Hagar to Abraham is being made now. And it was an acceptable custom of the day, as we've said. Bilhah would become a wife, a second-class wife, as it were, a concubine, just like Hagar had become to Abraham. And any children she would bear would legally be Rachel's children. So Rachel is wanting to have children through her handmaid, Bilhah, who would have to become a legal wife now. Okay, and then she also says this, that I may have children by her. That I may have children by her. Literally, that I may be built up by her. That I may be built up by her is what the Hebrew says. And, of course, the idea is that she wants to have children and increased and be built up in the eyes of her husband and the whole family by her handmaid. In type, we see Christians seeking to build the church through carnal means. They want to build the church. They see the need to get the church going, but they're doing it in a carnal way. Legalism is one good example of this. Trying to accomplish the will of God and the plan of God by making rules and regulations in our flesh. And it's very, very easy to fall into that trap. And the Apostle Paul had to deal with that constantly. It's trying in the flesh to produce, you know, the promised son, just as we've already discussed with Ishmael and Isaac. Okay, verse 4. And she gave him Bilhah, her handmaid, to wife, and Jacob went in unto her. And verse 5, and Bilhah conceived and bare Jacob a son. And Rachel said, God hath judged me, and hath also heard my voice, and hath given me a son. Therefore called she his name Dan. Dan means judge. So the name is given on the basis of the fact that Rachel now is interpreting this as being God judging her, giving her a son, and judging in a positive sense here now, and judging her worthy, as it were, and giving her a son through her handmaid. But, of course, this wasn't through Rachel herself. Verse 7, and Bilhah, Rachel's maid, conceived again and bare Jacob a second son. And Rachel said, with great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed. And she called his name Naphtali, of course, which means wrestlings. Now, this word great wrestlings in the Hebrew is interesting. It's literally wrestlings of God, with wrestlings of God. Some feel that means that this means that she struggled in prayer with God. But, you know, after the manner of later on in chapter 32, Jacob's going to be wrestling with God. But the word is different in Hebrew in that instance for wrestling there than it is here. And it's probably best to take it as a Hebrewism for mighty wrestlings. And wrestlings of God, the word Elohim probably meaning mighty and strong, the wrestlings of the strong and mighty. In other words, mighty wrestlings or God-sized wrestlings or something like that. In other words, a real strong struggle rather than attributing anything spiritual to the wrestlings themselves. That's the way the King James took it here, and that seems to be the best in light of the context of everything else. She's not really wrestling with God in prayer and so forth here. Her view seems to be more wrestlings with her sister, that kind of wrestlings from the context. And we see that there are carnal struggles within the church, too. We've already kind of noted that, but there's wrestlings within the church. And over ministries and over who's going to bring forth the most and so forth. We find in Corinth there was carnality there in the early church. I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas. There's wrestlings and struggle. Paul indicated in Philippians that some preach the gospel in the spirit of rivalry and contention, you see, out of strife, supposing to add more to his sorrows and burdens in prison and so forth. But he says, nevertheless, I rejoice that Christ is preached. He doesn't like the fact that the motives aren't all pure, but if the gospel message is coming out okay, people still can get saved. All right? Then there's a struggling of the flesh and the spirit also, we've already alluded to. And in that respect, we can see this isn't quite as clear-cut as, say, the struggle between Ishmael and Isaac, because there it's pretty clear who's on the wrong side, who's on the right side. Here, you'd be a little bit more hard-pressed to identify Leah, say, as the flesh and Rachel as the spirit, because Rachel's not manifesting too much of the spirit of God here, so it gets a little bit more difficult to assign it quite that way. Now, verse 9. And when Leah saw that she had left bearing, she took Zilpah, her handmaid, and gave her to Jacob to wife. So now she's going to play the same game. She left off bearing. She's not having more children. She can't keep up with Rachel now. So she's going to give her handmaid, and then they're going to have some more children. And Zilpah, Leah's maid, bare Jacob a son. And Leah said, a troop cometh, and she called his name Gad. Now the Hebrew here for Gad means the more literal translation of a troop cometh. Some of the ancient versions, in other words, some of the ancient translations and the commentaries and so forth, render it differently. They render it as good fortune or good luck or and so forth. Good luck has come, or with the help of Gad, which was a Babylonian god. It's mentioned in Isaiah 65:11 in the Hebrew. And so they attribute this to being maybe an allusion to a Babylonian god of fortune and that type of thing, prosperity. But the Hebrew is best translated, a troop cometh here, and I think it's a real mistake to claim that they're naming their son after some Babylonian god. That's just a little bit too hard to imagine. And especially in view of the fact that in chapter 49, verse 19, there's a prophecy there later on at the end of the book of Genesis with regard to these sons and the tribes that are to come from them. It says, Gad, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. And so he's talking about what's going to happen to the tribe of Gad. It says, a troop shall overcome, but he shall overcome at the last. Seems to be picking up on this idea of a troop cometh, not on the idea of good luck or good fortune. And luck itself is not a concept that the Scripture is promoting. It's not chance and luck. When God's blessing, it's God's blessing. It's attributed to God. It's not something that's attributed to just good fortune or chance or that type of thing. Those concepts come from paganism. Okay, verse 12. And Zilpah, Leah's maid, bare Jacob a second son. And Leah said, happy am I, for the daughters will call me blessed. And she called his name Asher. Asher means blessed. So the daughters will call me blessed as a result of another son now. Okay, so she's running up the score on sons here and has two more by her handmaid. Verse 14. And Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them unto his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, give me, I pray thee, of thy son's mandrakes. Okay, let's see here. I think I'll stop here and make a few comments on this. This is an exceedingly strange situation to our modern custom. Reuben is going in at the time of the wheat harvest, and he finds what are called mandrakes. Now, apparently mandrakes were small, yellow, apple-like fruit that had a sweet fragrance with small white and green flowers. And they were thought in ancient times to be an aphrodisiac. In other words, to promote fertility and so forth and reproducing children. And they were thought to cause barren women to conceive. It was a superstitious thing that it would increase sexual desire and it would cause a barren woman to conceive. Now, this was purely superstition. This is not something that God is condoning. God isn't saying, if you want to have children, go find some mandrakes, you know. That isn't. This is not something that God's promoting. This is a record of what they did and their superstitions and so forth. The Hebrews used to call them love apples because of that. And apparently they were narcotic and has caused dizziness and exhilaration and so forth, like, you know, a lot of plants and so forth have these toxins and so forth. So that perhaps helped promote the idea that they were an aphrodisiac because of the feelings and so forth that are associated with them. So drug problems are not solely a modern phenomena. This may not have been as serious a drug problem as some things we see today, but there were some connections here. The root of the plant was supposedly in the shape of a man, or at least that's the way they imagined it. And so they maybe associated that with bringing forth life and that type of thing as well. Now, so she says, give me of thy son's mandrakes. So Leah's son Reuben had found them. And Rachel is now saying to Leah, give me, I pray thee, of the son's mandrakes. She wants to have the mandrakes so she can have more, she can be have her womb open and have children. So in other words, she's not going to God to seek God to have her, him open the womb, but she's taking methods like this, trying anything that she can. And here again is a picture of the invisible church and the saints using the works of flesh and legalism to try to produce sons of God, trying to go this natural route, even though it was a superstitious thing. She's desperate. She's trying anything she can. She wants to get a hold of those mandrakes. Maybe that'll do the trick in her mind. So verse 15, and she said unto her, is it a small matter that thou hast taken my husband? And wouldest thou take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore shall he lie with thee tonight for thy son's mandrakes. So she's going to make a deal to allow Leah, her sister, to lie with Jacob that night in order to get some mandrakes in return. Now, apparently, Jacob had not been making love with Leah as much time as he had with Rachel, or for some time. And he'd been spending a lot of time with these handmaids and with Rachel and so forth. And so Rachel wants the mandrakes bad enough to allow Jacob to lie with Leah that night for them. And see how deplorable the situation is getting here. And God is recording it all for us. He's saying, this is the way they were. Okay. And so, lest anybody consider polygamy as an alternate lifestyle, be forewarned here. Verses 16 and 17. And Jacob came out of the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, thou must come in unto me, for surely I have hired thee with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. So that's where the idea of hiring comes from, you see. So she's buying his favor from Rachel. And so he lied with her that night. And God hearkened unto Leah, and she conceived and bare Jacob the fifth son. So he's again seeing Leah being despised and so forth. So now she's getting a fifth son. And Leah said, God hath given me my hire, because I have given my maiden to my husband. And she called his name Issachar. Issachar means hired. So she's relating this whole thing to that circumstance. And again, we see the Jews going about to establish their own righteousness. Leah, as well as Rachel, are trying to do this in the flesh. Romans 10:3 with that. Not receiving God's righteousness, they've gone about to establish their own righteousness. And so she's hiring it out. She's paying for it in the flesh, as it were. Okay, and then verse 19. And Leah conceived again and bare Jacob a sixth son. Even after this circumstance now. And Leah said, God hath endued me with a good dowry. Now will my husband dwell with me, because I have borne him six sons. And she called his name Zebulun. So this idea of dwelling. See, she's still trying to get his favor. Now my husband will dwell with me, you know. And it still hasn't happened. And Zebulun, of course, means dwelling, because she wanted him to dwell with her. I have borne him six sons. That ought to do it. You know, I've got more works to compile. You see, and those in the flesh, they never learn the lesson. They just keep trying to add more works. If I just get enough works, then God will favor me. Then God's anointing will be upon me. If I do enough good works, then I'll earn it. But you'll never earn it no matter how many good works you do. What you need to do is get to the basis of the whole matter and maintain a love relationship with him and receive his grace, and then go forth to do works, not to earn a position before God, but as a manifestation of your love for him. Okay, now going on, notice that nothing ever happens with those mandrakes. Presumably Leah Rachel got the mandrakes and so forth, but that wasn't the thing that opened her womb. We'll find that it's God that does it. And the mandrakes are just never mentioned. The only thing that ever happened with the mandrakes is that Leah got to be with Jacob that night, and it wasn't because of the mandrakes. She gave up the mandrakes, and she had a son. Okay? But verse 21, and afterwards she bare a daughter and called her name Dinah. So that's the daughter there. Now, I don't know that we can say for sure this was the only daughter that was ever had here, but this was mentioned, the only one that's mentioned at least. It is quite a string of probability to have 12 sons with only one daughter, but I guess things like that have happened. Dinah means judgment in Hebrew, and Jacob later had other daughters. We'll find references to those, Genesis 37, 35, Genesis 46, verses 7 and 15. But this may have been the only daughter within the span that these 12 sons were born. That's perhaps why she's mentioned. And she's the only one whose name is given and whose mother's name is given. So this is the only one that there's any significance attached to as far as naming and so forth, perhaps because of where she falls in this whole picture. Verse 22, and God remembered Rachel and hearkened unto her and opened her womb. So here it's very clear. Didn't say, now the mandrakes finally worked and so forth, and Rachel had a son. It says God hearkened to her. Well, the mandrakes are all forgotten now. And the mandrakes didn't do her any good, but God did. And God has humbled her now. Now he can work the answer to her prayers. And now she's not no longer striving in the flesh, at least at this time. And God hearkens unto her and opened her womb. And it says he hearkened unto her, which suggests that she's been crying out to God now, and that she's starting to get to the right source now for the problem. Verse 23, and she conceived and bare a son and said, God hath taken away my reproach. And she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. So it's kind of a prophetic promise to get another son. Joseph means adding in Hebrew, adding. And so she says, the Lord shall give to me another son. It's kind of a testimony there's another son yet to come. And that one won't come for a while in time, up until chapter 35. But that adding would give a full 12 sons, and that would be more of a typological pattern. There were 11 up to this point, and that's not quite typologically complete. So there's some things typologically that maybe need to be considered there. But she says, the Lord shall add to me another son. She's got hope and faith that there's going to be yet one more. Verse 25, and it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go into mine own place and to my country. Now, so he's requesting to be sent away. Perhaps the Lord had laid it upon his heart now to request a change. Jacob's sons were growing, and he needed to provide for them. Isaac was old now. He wasn't dead yet. Jacob will get to see him again. But Isaac was old, and Jacob was his heir, so he wanted to return to the promised land, and perhaps he's hoping that by this much time Esau is simmered down some, and his 14 years of service for his wives is now over, and so he's requesting to go back to his own country. Verse 27, and Laban said to him, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. So he said, I don't want to let you go. God's blessing me because you're here. He learned by experience. Now, the Hebrew is more interesting, though. For experience, the Hebrew is I learned by enchantments. And so it involves something not so spiritually edifying. Laban couldn't understand why his flocks increased so much when Jacob took care of them. And in order to find out Jacob's secret, he used some sort of divination or soothsaying or something of this nature and discovered that it was Yahweh that was blessing him. So that's the reason why he finds this out. So he consulted some necromancer or some soothsayer or something like that, and they told him that it was Yahweh's blessing. Sometimes they'll tell the truth. The demons know why this has happened. The prosperous thing here. Now, although Laban was related to Abraham and he knew about Yahweh, he certainly he also held certain pagan beliefs and practices. Remember that Ur was a place of idolatry and false gods, and that the family had come from idolatry. Terah had worshipped idols in Ur and so forth, and so Laban was of the same family. And we know that he had teraphim, which were household gods, which were small idols in the home and so forth. Chapter 31, verse 19, which will there'll be a whole situation that will develop around that situation in a bit. So God allows Laban to get the message even through his enchantments. It's almost as though like the situation with Saul consulting the witch of Endor, and Samuel did appear, just to the surprise of the witch there. She had nothing to do with it. It wasn't because of the divination, but it was because God wanted him to know what the situation was, and it was a testimony to him. So he didn't want to let him go because he recognizes that there's blessing here. But it's not by experience, it's by enchantment that he's found this out. Verse 28. And he said, appoint me thy wages, and I will give it. So now he's, you know, he's, whatever you want, I'll give it. He didn't have any more daughters to give, so he offers money or property or something of this nature, some sort of material wage. And he said unto him, thou knowest how I have served thee, and how thy cattle was with me. Verse 30, for it was little which thou hadst before I came, and it is now increased unto a multitude. And Yahweh hath blessed thee since my coming. And now when shall I provide for mine own house also? So he's concerned about his own house. Jacob has unselfishly served Laban for years, but now he must meet the growing responsibilities of his own household. He's got a lot of children, 11 sons there and a daughter. And so he's got that concern, and he doesn't want to stay and be working for someone else and increasing someone else's family when God's called him. And remembers the call of God, too, that God said he was going to increase him and multiply him, and it's been happening as far as his sons are concerned. There's some parallel passages here, too, as far as this principle. Romans 12:11. Not to be slothful in business, Romans 12:11, and 1 Timothy 5:8. If you don't provide for your own, those in your own house, you've denied the faith, you're worse than an infidel. So Jacob is recognizing his responsibility to provide for his own rather than just be giving and laboring for someone else. I'm sure he had enough to live on, basically, but he wanted to provide for his family, and he wanted to establish his own patriarchal, you know, clan, as it were, and recognizing that God's blessing was upon him, that God wanted to work through him. He wants to break free of the situation. In verse 31, and he said, what shall I give thee? And Jacob said, thou shalt not give me anything. If thou wilt do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep thy flock. Okay, so you should not give me anything. In other words, Jacob did not want Laban to give him anything. He didn't want to be indebted to a selfish and deceptive schemer like he'd already gotten involved with. But he knew that God would supply whatever he needed. And so he's having confidence in God. In verse 32, to 36, I'll read this whole section here, and then you'll see what he's got in mind. It says, I will pass through all thy flock today, removing from thence all the speckled and spotted cattle, and all the brown cattle among the sheep, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and of such shall be my hire. So shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come, when it shall come for my hire before thy face. Every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats, and brown among the sheep, that shall be counted stolen with me. And Laban said, behold, I would it might be according to thy word. And he removed that day the he-goats that were ring-straked and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, and every one that had some white in it, and all the brown from among the sheep, and gave them into the hand of his sons. And he set 3 days' journey betwixt himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. Okay, now here's this scheme or this plan that Jacob is concocting here would leave it up to God to bless Jacob. In other words, he didn't want to have it said, and we saw something similar with Abraham, where he wouldn't take the riches of the king of Sodom. He said, you keep the riches and so forth. All he wanted was Lot and his the loved ones. He didn't want to have it said that Laban was the one who blessed Jacob. And so he recognized that God had blessed Laban for Jacob's sake. He hadn't blessed Laban. It was because Jacob had been there. And so Jacob was not going to take any of Laban's animals that presently existed. Rather, he agreed to continue to tend Laban's flocks, and his pay would consist of animals that would be born, that would be speckled, striped, or spotted. And you see, these would be less desirable to Laban because of their markings. In other words, the desirable ones were the ones that had no markings on them, that were pure and so forth, and were unspotted. And so it would be then entirely up to God as to how many animals would become Jacob's. In other words, it would be God. He just made a deal ahead of time before the animals were even born that the ones that are spotted and so forth, they're going to be mine. And so we'll just leave it up to God to see, and only God is going to be able to control this. So Jacob agreed that no solid colored animals would be taken into his own flocks. And only those future animals born speckled, striped, or spotted, or abnormally colored in some way would become Jacob's wages. So this seemed in Laban's figure that's a fair deal. I mean, it's just a matter of genetics and so forth, and the probabilities and so forth. So, of course, they didn't use it in terms like that, but they had enough experience to know how often, how frequently these things happened and so forth. And the dominant color traits in Laban's flocks were apparently white among the sheep, black among the goats and brown among the cattle. That seemed to be the dominant strain. And so most of the animals were these colors, but there were a few that were spotted and speckled among the cattle and goats, and a few brown among the sheep. And so that would be Jacob's pay, just the ones that were, you know, not spotted and so forth. And Jacob went even further. He said none of the speckled animals would be used for breeding purposes. They would be kept in a separate flock away from the normal colored animals, and so they wouldn't be a part of the whole breeding scheme. And so that would make it much less likely. You see, if you just took speckled ones alone and interbred those, you'd probably get a lot of speckled ones, but he's not going to do it that way. And so it would be far much less likely that the far more numerous normal colored animals would bear the striped and speckled offspring than it would be that the striped and speckled themselves interbreeding would. In other words, if you take two dogs that are both multicolored, you know, you probably have a lot of multicolored offspring. But if you take two dogs that are pure black and so forth, the probability of getting the multicolored ones is much less genetically. This is a very interesting account, you know, in view of modern understanding of genetics, because, you know, they in those days didn't understand those things, but they did observe things. I mean, just like anybody can observe, but they didn't have a real, you know, scientific basis for all of that. Okay, now going on, so that's the deal that he's presenting to Laban here, and to Laban that sounds real good. Okay, verse 37 to 43, continue here, see what happened. And Jacob took him rods of green poplar and of the hazel and chestnut tree, and filled white streaks in them, and made the white appear which was in the rods. And he set the rods which he had pilled before the flocks in the gutters of the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to drink. And the flocks conceived before the rods, and brought forth cattle ring-straked, speckled, and spotted. And Jacob did separate the lambs, and set the face of the flocks toward the ring-straked, and all the brown in the flock of Laban. And he put his own flocks by themselves, and put them not unto Laban's cattle. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger cattle did conceive, that Jacob laid the rods before the eyes of the cattle in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the cattle were feeble, he put them not in. He didn't want the weak ones, you know. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. In other words, when he'd see the stronger one breeding, he'd put the rods in front of them, so they'd see the rods. And this sounds so preposterous, but it's not. This is not a scientific cause and effect. This was done for symbolic and typological reasons, and just believing God that He's going to work this out. I'm not sure. I don't think that Jacob himself believed that there was a cause. If they looked at striped sticks, that they'd bring forth striped offspring. But it was in touch of a sign here. That is going to take place, and he's just recording it. God's just recording it the way that Jacob was thinking of it, and God worked to bless. And the man increased exceedingly, and had much cattle, and maid servants, and men servants, and camels, and asses. So this is now. There have been those that come and attack the scriptures and say, "See what a preposterous story this is. How in the world could having striped sticks of different stripes, looking at them while you're conceiving, have any effect?" I mean, I suppose Lamarck probably would have liked that explanation in his view of how evolution proceeded by inheritance of acquired characteristics. But there's obviously no connection naturally with what you're looking at the time of conception. So it's possible that Jacob believed a superstition and then God blessed him in spite of it, or it just may be that he's just being goaded of God to do something symbolic. Lots of times things are done symbolically. You know, placing a symbol of the striped while they're conceiving, and they bring forth that way. But he's not giving some technical method. You know, if farmers and herdsmen and so forth could come up with something like this, you know, they could breed any kind of cattle they wanted if they thought that was a natural gimmick. But it's not. It was something that God was going to do supernaturally, and these things were done as a witness for that. And so he manipulates, and he's even able to select among the cattle whether they want strong ones or weak ones. And he puts the sticks in front of one and gets one type and not the other. It's quite interesting. So it's a supernatural miracle, just like anything else that God does. And God was using it to bless him, and it's quite a remarkable thing. But this is not a testimony of biblical errancy or something of that nature. It's a miracle that God did on the basis of some circumstances that took place. And God has often done, you know, when God caused the sun to stand still for Joshua, you know, I mean, that's impossible. How can you do that? How can the sun stand still? That would mean that either God is actually putting the sun in motion relative to the earth, so it makes it appear because the earth's turning, or God caused the earth to stand still. Can you imagine what a dynamic problem that is? To take an object of that mass that's rotating and stop that momentum for a moment and then start it again. I don't know that that's what he did, but he's certainly capable of it. I mean, anything that violent would result in a catastrophe that would break things apart in the natural. But God could also hold it together, keep that from happening. Or it may have been an effect of the light. God could have caused some sort of refraction or something like that to take place for a time. Could have suspended time itself. I mean, there's all kinds of things that God can do. He's got a lot of options available. Because we can't figure out exactly what he did, you know, I mean, an infinite number, you know, anything he wants, he can do. It's not like us, so we have to figure out, how could this be reasonable? We figure out a method. This is one of the mistakes that can be made when people try to find natural explanations for miracles of the Bible. There are some that get really good at this, some liberal commentaries and so forth, who don't believe in any supernatural. I've often wondered, why do they even bother reading the Bible if they don't believe in the supernatural? Why just not just throw it away and forget it? But a lot of them have motives of trying to undermine anybody's confidence in it. So they come in and they say, well, I've read one account where the reason that the plagues took place in Egypt, which we'll get into next semester, was that Moses had superior technology, and he found a way to pollute the Nile River upstream. And the pollution, you know, whatever he put into it caused it to turn red. And then it caused the fish to die and things, you know, and things, the frogs to all run out of the water because they didn't like the polluted water. And then the frogs died, and so the flies came as a result of that. And they just tried to explain everything on the basis of some natural circumstance. But I noticed they kind of trailed off their explanation about the time that we get into this plague of darkness, and that's darkness everywhere, and no artificial light except in the land of Goshen where they had light, or the plague of this strange disease that attacks only the firstborn of every family and so forth. It's a little bit hard to explain. So they go so far, but then, of course, they talk about the Red Sea being just a shallow marsh, 6 inches deep and so forth, and then they trail off the explanation about the time that we have to account for all the Egyptian army being drowned in 6 inches of water. It's a real mistake, and I think the same is true here. This was a supernatural event. God was the one, clearly, through all of this, that blessed Jacob. So God was the one that was working through the genetic system to change the ratios of offspring and the colors of them and so forth. He's got control over the genetic system. He can certainly manipulate those things. Or it doesn't even have to be a direct manipulation. It can just be a manipulation of the probabilities. Because the genetic information for both the solid colors and the multicolor and so forth was probably there. Only one was probably dominant genes, the other were recessive. Just a matter of adjusting the ratios of the offspring. No problem at all for God. So this is a miracle that God did, not something that Jacob himself found some mystical cause and effect relationship here. Otherwise, they'd be doing this all the time. And Jacob wasn't fancying that this is the way you do it whenever you want to get cattle ratios to change, just put sticks in front of their eyes. I think in his own mind, he was doing something as a witness for a testimony to what God is going to do. And so I can just see Laban later on carving sticks and so forth, you know, trying to get this thing to work. It didn't work because God was the one that was blessing him. Okay, chapter 31, verse 1. And he heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob hath taken away all that was our father's. And of that which was our father's hath he gotten all this glory. So here we see jealousy and greed again causing them to twist the facts. The Jacob's sons are saying Jacob has taken away all that was our father's and making him sound like he was the culprit here when he had made an agreement and it was something that God had caused to come to pass. So they twist the facts to deceive people. This is so typical. I mean, this is just the same kind of thing that happens when God blesses someone, somebody gets out of sorts, they get jealous, they start twisting the facts. They try to make the one who's being blessed of God look like the deceiver. Laban was comparatively poor when Jacob had arrived 20 years before, and now God had blessed him. Chapter 30 and verse 30 says, For it was little which thou hadst before I came. So he didn't have a whole lot. Laban wasn't a wealthy man when Jacob came, but now that Jacob had been with him and laboring and been faithful, God had increased him, and Laban was rich. And so God had blessed Laban, and they accepted it. But now they won't allow God to bless Jacob, and now they want to cause problems. Laban's sons saw their inheritance slipping away, too. Now that Jacob's gone, the blessing of God was gone, their inheritance was withering away, there was bitterness, there was jealousy. Of course, the devil has a heyday here. Verse 2, And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. So now his attitude has changed. Laban, who was before him before, even though he pulled some pretty dastardly deeds, by and large, now there's animosity. Through Jacob, Laban had become rich, but now he turns and becomes an enemy, and again turns against Jacob because God has given more to his son-in-law than to him. So jealousy is a terrible thing, even spiritual jealousy. You know, you're taking this, transferring this into the spiritual counterpart. Who are the ones that we have the most problems with? You know, let's take Community Chapel, for example, what God has done here. The people that we have the most trouble with are the ones that are the closest to us in many respects, as far as their theology and so forth. But they're seeing God bless this work and move us on and move us deeper. And differences in theology and so forth make them more hostile toward us than even the heathen out there. We're not having trouble with the unbelievers by and large. It's other Pentecostals. It's others that are spirit-filled, but that are circulating rumors and so forth. Beware of Community Chapel and all this. That's the primary source of the problems that we have. And it's not difficult to see. When God's blessings on someone, either people will acknowledge it and humble themselves before God, or they're going to be jealous. They're going to be fighting it. They're going to be hostile toward it. They're going to be looking for excuses or rationale or something of this nature. And here we see it here. Verse 2. Excuse me, we read that, but the countenance was not the same. The problem here, of course, was pride and jealousy. And we've got to acknowledge God's right to bless others according to his own will. We've got to learn that lesson, no matter who we are. Even within the assembly, God begins to put his hand on some brother or sister and begin to raise them up and exalt them and bless them. The natural thing to do is to become jealous. I wish I was in that position. And jealousy breeds criticism, looking for something wrong with them. You know, they might preach a wonderful sermon, but you might say, well, yeah, all except in this part. You know, you made a mistake here, or you pronounced this word wrong, or this or that. Something to try to bring it down a little bit so it doesn't look quite as good, so you look better by comparison. I mean, if we're honest, we can see that the devil works in those areas in our hearts, tries desperately to get us jealous, get us at odds, get us in some way to try to tear our brother down so that we look better by comparison. That's very typical of what legalism does as well. With legalism usually goes spirits of criticism and self-righteousness and an attempt to try to drag others down. And, of course, that usually results in putting lots of pressure on people, putting lots of, you know, making judgments and measuring them by your standard, etc., and being critical to try to pull them down so you don't look quite so bad. It's a very, very difficult thing. It's a real test of spirituality when you can find yourself honestly from the heart wanting to see someone exalted, even if they're one that's in the same similar position to yourself, even if they're one that's taking a position that you might have had. It's a rare thing to see where a person's really got that selflessness. Jonathan and David is a beautiful example in the scriptures. Mm-hmm. Jonathan, who was the son of Saul, who was in line for the throne, was working to promote David. It's a real rare thing to see. And apart from the grace of God and God's working in our lives, we can't do it. Our flesh is just not going to produce that kind of thing. Your flesh is always going to be looking out for old number one. But when you put Jesus as number one and begin to learn to put the flesh under, we can overcome that. So here we see the natural circumstances, and it's something we see before us every day. So his countenance is no longer toward him. I don't know how many of you have had the experience of meeting somebody out there and meeting their Christian. You start telling them, talking to them, you know, praise the Lord and so forth, and they say, where do you go to church? And I say, Community Chapel. And all of a sudden, the countenance is not the same as it was before. Kind of a ashen white look on their face or something, or they change the subject and so forth. That's happened too many times. It's really tragic. It's really tragic. They've heard rumors and so forth. You see, before they knew, they were having fellowship with you. It was great. You know, and then they find out, because of the rumors and all the rest, everything changes. It's really too bad. Verse 3. But it's going to happen. It happened to Jacob. It happened to Jesus. It happened to Paul. It's going to happen to us. We have to recognize that. Verse 3, and the Lord said unto Jacob, return unto the land of thy fathers, and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee. So God now tells him, you return. And Jacob's getting his marching orders from God at the right time here. And he was apparently still under contract to keep Laban's flocks, but at the rate that things were going, it's likely that Laban would not honor it and would take Jacob's flocks by force. Chapter 31, verse 42 is an indication of that, reading ahead here. Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me away now empty. So, in other words, the conditions were such that Jacob did suspect that Laban would not honor his agreement and take all the flocks and send him away empty. Okay. But there was a mistake. Now, God told Jacob to get out, but he made a mistake again in sneaking out. In verse 20, just again taking a little peek ahead, and Jacob stole away unawares to Laban the Syrian, in that he had told him not that he fled. And that wasn't the proper way to do it. If God was really commanding him, if God was in control here, he should have just gone to Laban and said, God has called me out, I'm going, and so forth, rather than stealing out and doing it by cunning this way. So God had commanded him to return to Canaan. And so, verse 4, and Laban sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field unto his flock, and said unto them, I see your father's countenance, that it is not toward me as before, but the God of my father hath been with me. So he's telling his family the situation. And he's secretly informing them of the situation again, not doing it openly. And if they didn't understand the whole situation, it's possible they would not want to leave their home. In other words, he's going to have to explain to them some of the behind-the-scenes information so that they are willing to go. Verses 6 and 7, and ye know that with all my power have I served your father, and your father hath deceived me, and changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. I'll read verse 8 also first. And if he said thus, the speckle shall be thy wages, then all the cattle bear speckled. And if he said thus, the ringstrake shall be thy hire, then bear all the cattle ringstraked. Thus God hath taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. So he's saying that God's the one that was behind this, and whatever Laban said would be his wages, that's the way the cattle came out. So whether it's speckled or striped. Now, when Laban saw the cattle were providing speckled cattle, you see, he would tell Jacob that he decided only the striped would be his wages. In other words, he's changing the wages all the time depending on what the cattle come out. He made one agreement with them, said, well, it'll all be the striped. And then, so they all come out striped, and so Laban says, no, we'll make it the spotted this time. And then they turn and all come out spotted. So he's having to keep changing the wages because he wants to try to get it the ratio that he likes. So when the cattle would start providing striped offspring, of course, he changed it again. In every case, the Lord had kept a blessing. You see, obviously, this is purely supernatural. It's the only way that this can work. God's following along. Whatever Laban says, God does the other thing, you know. And he can't fight the blessing of God. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 13, there is a reference. So the Lord kept blessing Jacob. And when God's blessing's on your life, it doesn't matter what people do. We'll find that with Joseph also. There's another man whose the blessing of God was upon his life, and no matter what people did to try to put him down, God always exalted him. Okay, verse 9. So that's what he means by changing his wages 10 times. He'd get, you know, whatever the cattle were coming out, he'd try to change it, and then it would change according to the way he said, and God would bless Jacob nevertheless. Okay, verse 9. And God had taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. Verse 10. And it came to pass at the time that the cattle conceived that I lifted up mine eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the cattle were ringstraked, speckled, and grizzled. So he had a dream. The rams here refer to he-goats. In the Hebrew, the he-goats. And it's the word that, and there's perhaps a slight change here in the, he says the cattle conceived. Because they're using the term cattle, they probably want to say rams because they don't think of goats as cattle. But the word for cattle in Hebrew is a lot broader. It doesn't mean, when we say cattle, we think of cows, you know, and steers and so forth. The word cattle in Hebrew can include sheep and goats and all kinds of things. In other words, the larger animals. Second bell? Okay, we'll stop there and get the rest of this interesting situation here covered next time. Okay, we have a test probably take the first hour to correct it and so forth. You'll have as much time as you need, but be sure and be prepared for that next time. God bless you.